And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm delighted to welcome Eric Barnes back to the program today. Eric is the publisher of several newspapers in Memphis, Tennessee, but we have him on the program to talk about his novels. His previous ones are Shimmer, Something Pretty, Something Beautiful, and The City Where We Once Lived. Today we'll be talking about Above the Ether, which is published by Arcade and distributed by Simon & Schuster. Eric, when we spoke last year about The City Where We Once Lived, you said that you'd written kind of a prequel. And it is kind of, because we don't start out anywhere close to the collapsed city that is featured in that book.
No, but they are moving towards the city eventually. I wanted them to work together, and you've read both, but I also want them to work on their own. I'm hopeful I pulled that off. I mean, I think the publisher calls it a sequel. I kind of would have called it a prequel, but they're actually happening roughly at the same time, and they are independent of each other, but they cross.
Yeah, they kind of meet up toward the end.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
But not perfectly.
Not perfectly, and intentionally so. I sort of wanted to sort of have all these things sort of glance together and overlap, so that for people who enjoyed City Where We Once Lived, they would sort of enjoy those crossovers and little other views of the world, but that if they hadn't read City, they wouldn't miss anything. And then if they did like Above the Ether, then maybe they go back and read City and get, you know, something out of that.
And when we talked about city, I think I used the wrong word. You talked about apocalyptic.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say it's really apocalyptic. It's just a whole lot of calamities happen at once at that point.
Yes. You were very articulate about that. It made me think about that. Yeah. I mean, apocalyptic implies, you know, post-bomb, post-plague, post-something, to me at least, you know. And Above the Ether, even more so, is all about warning signs and sort of where are we going. And honestly, I mean, you know, I tried it with Above the Ether, that by and large, everything in the book, while maybe exaggerated or kind of pushed to an extreme, these are things that have happened, you know, kind of pulled together. But they are things that have happened, the things of the flood or, you know, I mean, the tsunamis that happen and various tsunamis in the Southeast or in Japan. And I mean, I wanted to kind of pull from real events. They might not all be in one place, but I wanted to pull from real events. So that apocalyptic. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we talked before, like, I mean, The Road is one of my favorite novels, and that is clearly apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic.
But the world is still functioning at this point. We might be circling the drain, starting to circle the drain a bit.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, again, like, you know, when you look at some of these things in Above the Ether that are about, I mean, it's not a political statement at all, but I mean, you talk about climate change or you talk about droughts or you talk about, you know, oil spills. I mean, all those things are happening. All those things do happen now. And so to kind of shed light on them through a book that is ostensibly America, but never named as that, and ostensibly the Southern Delta, but not in the Midwest, but never named as that. I mean, you could substitute in other places, whether it's, like I said, Southeast Asia or Japan. All the kinds of things felt to me like events I'd read about in one way or another in the New York Times.
What do you gain? What do you appreciate about keeping those locations vague in these last two books?
I think my intent is that it allows people to impose some of their own image on the book, on the places, and on the people. So I think I said to you when we were talking about City, where I don't name any of the characters, that it came out of my hating to write physical description, you know, just a writerly thing that I just don't do that very well or don't – I'm just not drawn to it. People just can imagine what these people look like, make it look like themselves or their brother or their best friend or their worst enemy or the woman they always loved or the man they always hated or, you know. So some of it was really more that I wanted it to make it more relatable as places and as people by not saying this happened in the Southern Delta, this happened in New York City or Detroit or Southeast Asia, because then you start going, oh, yeah, I have all my perceptions of Southeast Asia or I have my perceptions of New York. I'd rather sort of say it's a city. I'd rather say it's a delta. I'd rather say it's, you know, a place. And because let their imaginations kind of join the book. The other thing is that if you're saying about, you know, things like plagues or droughts, if you name it, then you can say, yeah, that's what happens there. That's a terrible place. If you name it The City Where We Once Lived, if you name it Detroit, or you name it New York in the 70s, or, you know, New Orleans after Katrina, then you can say, yeah, that was terrible what happened there. That could never happen here because it happened somewhere else. So I think that was always sort of in very much in my mind, that I didn't want to give people a sense of that these are things that happened somewhere else. And instead, there are things that could happen here, wherever here is, and to people you know, whoever they are.
the first calamity we really run across in the book is that tsunami hurricane 1-2 punch down on the Gulf. And we have a man who's just known as the father. Yet again, you've refused to give us any names. And he is always just a half step ahead. When he sees the tsunami alerts, he gets his young children out of town. He sees the wave coming a little bit later when they're on the highway. He's able to get them to higher ground. He is just that little bit much ahead of the other people there.
Yeah. And he thinks to himself about how lucky he was. I mean, it was not a sort of heroic, bold, courageous act so much as just a moment of panic that I think in my mind, you know, there's almost a sense that he's thinking more about his kids, that had he been in his home and this earthquake, you know, and all these things hit at once, he might not have jumped in to get in the car so quickly. You know, it's kind of a safety thing about protecting his kids. But that doesn't make it so much that he's a hero or courageous in any sense. It's just total instinct for him. You know, he has the instinct when they are stranded with some strangers on basically on a hillside that he doesn't want to share any of his food with these strangers, not because he doesn't care about them, but because all he wants to do is protect his children and save his food for his children. He does. But I think in the book, it actually says he shares their food with others because he doesn't want his kids to think otherwise, you know, mm-hmm. But really it's all about protection of his children as motivation.
And if we've learned anything through the calamities that have happened for real in America, people tend to be very generous in those situations.
They do. Yes. And so why, you know, why is that? And why is it that, you know, I think different people are different about that. There's another thing in that scene where a woman and her companion are stuck in mud and no one goes to help her, partly because they all recognize that if they go out there, they're probably going to die too. And she doesn't yell for help even because she realizes her situation that she and her companion are in. And so I liked all that. I like all that kind of idea of not clear lines of total generosity or total heroism. But they're also not dark. It's not purely selfish. It's just the complexity of people in those really difficult situations.
And you talk about not liking to write physical description, but just the description of the mud slowly making the way up the man's body. It was just chilling.
It's physical characteristics that I'm really bad at and, you know, what people look like. But I will admit that it was actually fun to write, you know, because it's just so horrifying. And that I can write about those things almost too much. That kind of physical world I like very much. The human physical descriptions is where I get, I don't know, I have some sort of mental block.
Do you have like face blindness or something?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's also imaginary face blindness.
And I am also, by the way, terrible at remembering people's names. And that may also be why these last two books I've stayed away from naming the people.
That situation with the tsunami is probably the most of the first three situations we went across, the most unlikely to happen because, I mean, the storm surge goes 150 miles inland. And I know it's flat down that way, but
that's
not quite.
Right, that's correct.
Probably won't happen. But the one that's most likely to happen is in the sections named for the stranger.
Yes.
And it's the wildfires out west. And we have a married couple. We know there's stress between them. And also there are fires all around their house. Why haven't they left?
Yeah. You know, I think they're in denial about it. And again, you know, I think that if you look at what's going on in California, and I wrote this before the most recent really tragic and awful fires, but they've been having fires. The San Diego fires of a few years ago were probably somewhere on my mind. You know, people begin to live with disaster and begin to accept it in a way that's kind of strange. And it is maybe in the book a little bit extreme in terms of how close the fires get at a certain point. But there are people living in California year after year after year with forest fires a couple subdivisions or a couple hills away, and they accept that. And I grew up out in the Northwest. I remember some of the big, big fires, people talking about, well, it was on the other side of the lake. What you and I, as people now living, you know, I live in Memphis, and, you know, that would be like, well, I don't care how close that fire is, we're getting out of here. People who live with forest fires begin to kind of normalize and accept. And that's not irrational. Some of that is they understand the dynamics, you know. I remember I had a friend in college who was from the most dangerous neighborhood in Brooklyn at the time. It was from Crown Heights. And he used to talk about it. It was kind of a badge of honor about how incredibly dangerous Crown Heights was. And one time he was talking about going to San Francisco or something. He goes, oh, God, I'd never go to San Francisco. I said, why? He goes, all the earthquakes. Sherwin, you own as a badge of honor and growing up in and living in one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in America. He goes, yeah, that's different. You can control that. But those earthquakes, that scares the heck out of me. And so I think there's this kind of way in which what do we live in fear of, and how do we normalize some of these things that go on? And again, with that couple, I mean, they have all this other pain going on that's kind of numbed them to the outer threats because they've just lived through such a horror internally.
In reading those sections with the stranger, I think it's nice that vagueness is kind of a hallmark of the book in a way, but we don't know which one of the two the stranger really refers to.
Yeah. I mean, they have come unglued, and it's very sad. And it's, you know, clear people who have had a whole life together with these children, so they've, you know, ostensibly been married for something like 20 years. I mean, you can sort of piece together, and then they've become strangers. There's some moments at the end, and it becomes clear that they weren't always like that. It's not like it's just this thing that happened to them internally. That has nothing to do with climate or anything on, you know, this sort of outer kind of catastrophes that are going on in the book. That's sort of this very personal catastrophe, arguably beyond their control, and how they became strangers to one another.
Because she has this level of bitterness to her, and he has this level of remove, and he's kind of curled back into himself.
Yeah.
And we don't know which one's the chicken and which one's the egg.
Yeah. And there's reference to where he used to be as angry and bitter as she was. You know, it's a kind of an offhand sort of comment. But in my mind, you know, it's just that he's broken in a different way. But he used to probably – I mean, if you played back their timeline, there was probably a time where he was in the role she's in the book, and she might have been in a different role of kind of more passive and more quiet. I mean, because they've just been circling in this kind of, you know, family hell for so long.
And what I thought was a kind of an unusual move for an author, because authors tend to try to be a little bit more neutral about the characters. There's one person in the family that's blamed in the book for what dragged the family down.
Yeah.
And that's an unusual take. Most people will try to let the reader decide out, but at least in the book, they point fingers at one person.
And I think that's what happens in families. I mean, I think I sadly have enough of experience with that people get to a point of blame, and, you know, their process of trying to make sense of mental illness or drug addiction in a family is just a kind of terrible one. You know, it even goes back to the, you know, you talk about blame. There's the Alcoholics Anonymous thing. I'm not in AA, but I've had friends in it. And I remember a writing instructor, Blanche McCrary Boyd, who's a great writer and was hugely inspirational to me in college. She was in AA then and talked about it. And somebody told a story about someone who was an alcoholic and how terrible it was. And she looked at him and she said, you know what we say in AA? And I said, no. And she said, better him than me. And I thought that always struck by me, because her point was not a cold-hearted one. It was just, you know, sometimes you have to save yourself. And that's part of dealing with addiction. And I think there's an argument that that's with severe mental illness. That's a part of it, is sadly saving yourself.
And there is, I think, a normal human behavior that's throughout a lot of your books that is normal, but it's gone to the point of pathology. And that's the ability to compartmentalize.
Yeah.
And there are people who just section off parts of their lives and do not address them for whatever reason throughout the books. And we have the investor.
Yeah.
Who basically, she makes money off disasters.
Yes. Well, because she made money off many ways, and then she found that she was making more money off investments that were, you know, basically what would be some kind of derivative or some kind of hedge against, you know, things going badly. And she made more money, and she was hired to make money. And her sort of worldview, that's what they hired her to do. She does not seem, at least in my reading of her, my intention with her is that she's particularly consumed with the money and material things. She doesn't live cheaply. But, you know, that's not what she's about, like buying boats and art. It's just that this is what I set out to do, so I'm going to keep doing it to the extreme I can possibly do it. There's a conversation she has with essentially one of her bosses where he wants to sort of downplay and spin what she does and kind of make it seem like it's something else. And she gets very frustrated with him and says, if you don't like what I'm doing, tell me. But we're not going to spin it. We're not going to call it anything but it is. And, you know, you go back to foreclosure crisis. You go back to all kinds of investment. Again, like as I often do in the books, I kind of take things to an extreme to make a point. But, you know, the people who were – if you read the Michael Lewis book on Big Short about the financial crisis, you realize people talk themselves into believing they were doing just investments, smart things. It wasn't people. It was just money. I mean, they kind of talked themselves into this whole – all these financial institutions – into believing that they weren't doing something wrong. But on some level, they should have all known they were doing something wrong. And had they maybe admitted that, you know, where would things have gone differently?
And there's another character later in the book, the carousel operator. There are things these two people are good at.
Yes.
And they may not necessarily be the best thing for society, but there is
right.
some affirmation that comes with doing something right. very well.
Right. And his is violence, right? I mean, so and the harm he causes people. And I think I just like to shed light on extremes, not to celebrate these people, because hopefully it definitely is not a celebration. I mean, the carousel operator, which, you know, because you've read Something Pretty, is essentially the narrator from Something Pretty kind of brought over. And not that they're sequels or prequels. It's just that character I wanted was in my mind, and I wanted to walk him through this world I created with Above the Ether. He is not a person to admire, and he's not in Something Pretty. I mean, he's not a hero in that sense where at the end you should go, well, yeah, he escaped from that whole life, and he – I don't think I would want anyone to view it that way. So I guess I enjoy that. I enjoy putting characters in those places. There are some good characters. There's some well-meaning people. We're focused on all the bad ones.
Well, no. We talked about the stranger.
Yeah, and, the father. The stranger.
But – that character from Something Pretty, Something Beautiful is the carousel operator in this book. And his name was Brian Porter.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until today I was going, Porter, oh, yeah, he's carrying around a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he is. I mean, you don't have to have read Something Pretty. I think the way it plays out in Above the Ether, I mean, he seems to just be this carousel operator. And he becomes kind of casual friends with somebody who operates the teacup rides. And they go out. And it becomes very clear that there's something terribly wrong in the carousel operator's past, which, again, if you read the book, you know. But if you haven't, you're just that baggage and all that he's sort of trying to escape by wandering the country and working with a traveling carnival. And again, you can outrun it. You can outrun the people he was with. You can outrun the circumstance, the place where he was. But he just keeps putting himself back or keeps ending up back in positions where the violence shows itself again.
And he has seemed to have forgotten why he left in the first place to
yes.
extract himself from that really horrible situation he was
right.
in.
Right. Yeah. And if you remember that book, I mean, there's that book like that
skips
one moves
around time,
skips
yeah.
around in time. And there's, you know, there are multiple characters, which I loved writing that way. And that's kind of why I end up coming back to it in City and especially in this one. There's some confusion in Something Pretty that Brian has about where he's been, and he's clearly forgotten some things. And so he's a little bit in that space in this book if I kind of align the timelines, which I don't really because very clearly, if not explicitly, Something Pretty takes place in sort of the 70s and 80s. This book is modern, but you know, it's my book, so I can do what I want.
Well, and also that book was first person.
Yes.
And so you have him later in life – maybe 30 years on talking about his life. So we know he survives for a few more
yes.
years into the future.
Yes, he does.
But in this book is in third person.
Yeah.
And so who's telling this story?
Yeah. This is the first book I've written in third person. There's some scenes in third person in Shimmer and in I think in City and in even in Something Pretty, a couple of the rotating characters, the girl is in third person, I think. I shouldn't draw a blank, but I am. But I know there's some parts in third person. This I just started in third person and stayed there, and I wish I knew why, but I don't. I did realize it was easier to move through characters. I knew I wanted to rotate through all these characters, kind of moving through a similar landscape towards a similar place. But it was freeing, actually, to write in the third person. I mean, incredibly freeing. And then to write about characters like Brian, who I'd written about before, I don't know why it was so freeing, but not that this matters, but on a pure writing level, I wrote this book, 90%+ of what you read right now, I wrote in 3 months. And I wrote it straight through with basically just kind of line editing after the fact. That was the 10%. But something about that third person and a couple of characters that I was familiar with and a place and tone from City that I was familiar with made the writing so quick and clear in my mind of what I wanted to do.
Also, I think you want us to see these characters from the outside. They're concealing things, and it's easier to conceal things from a third person
yeah.
point of view than it is from a first person. And whereas the narrator in the city where we once lived had such a compressed emotional range
right.
that he was inaccessible to us for much of the book.
Yes.
But for that particular reason, and you couldn't carry that over to every character in the new book.
Right, exactly. I mean, there was a claustrophobic thing about City on some level, and we may have talked about that. I mean, that was kind of intentional. I didn't want that claustrophobic thing. I wanted that tone and that kind of place and versions of that world I created in City, but I wanted just the freedom for the reader and for me writing to move around more, move through time more, move through more emotional ranges and different perspectives. And people like, you know, we've talked about some of the really darker characters, but also some of the better characters or better, you know, more contributing to society, you know, more positive kind of characters.
Well, and I noticed on the sections for The Stranger how the language they used was very formal and that
it was
very straight up and down, and it was not in any way seemed familiar with each other. It just seemed like calculated to deliver this one little bit of information. Don't put any shading on it. Just make it as direct as possible without kind of starting another fight.
That's interesting. Yeah. Formal. I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, I mean, it's clearly they're holding back so much pain that if they open up even the slightest bit, it all comes out. And it does sometimes in some of their sort of ugly sort of fighting.
And in The Investor, she's cordoned off her sexuality in this one very prescribed box. And at one point she says it reminds her of a character in a book.
Yeah.
And that book is your first novel, Shimmer.
Yeah. These are the fun things I get to do now that I have a fourth book coming out. So yeah, I wanted to come back to Shimmer, not as a sequel, but I liked those characters and there's another few references to Shimmer in there. And it is interesting to come back to characters I wrote. And, you know, Shimmer I wrote in the mid to early 2000s and was published in 2009, so 10 years ago. So it's funny how that stuff sort of cooks in your brain and morphs. And I haven't read Shimmer in many years. And I hadn't read Something Pretty in quite a few years when I wrote this. But then to come back to Brian, as I remember Brian, was interesting and helpful and kind of fun, I mean, honestly.
And two of the characters from Shimmer pop up in these little strange interstitial bits in the restaurant manager section in part two of the book.
Yes. Yeah, because it kind of fit. You know, this book is about all these different kinds of awful things going on. And Shimmer fundamentally is about a company built on a lie and the two cousins, Robbie and Trevor, having created this lie and then lying to themselves and just kind of taking all these people down this – they don't realize they're going down this dark path, but they're going down this terrible path. And so I kind of wanted to see if I could bring that back in because thematically that part of it, a company built on a lie that fundamentally is being dismissive of the thousands of people who work for it, that was thematically it fit in some ways with some of what was going on. It wasn't that far away from The Investor, you know, in terms of thematically. So.
And in the first part of the book, you have these kind of interstitial pages that have like a paragraph or two of a situation in there. And in the second part of the book, you have these interstitials within the chapters themselves.
Yeah.
I was just wondering about what were the purpose of the interstitials and why did you move from between chapters to inside the chapters for the second part?
I think partly it was just pacing, you know, like the little interstitial parts were really far apart and then closer together, all that sort of setting some kind of pace that plays out towards the end as the characters come closer together. It was also a way, back to the third person, it was a way to just constantly shed more light on the world. I not only could go through six different characters through the book, primary characters or situations, because there are a couple of couples in there. But then, you know, if you're doing a straight first-person narrative and you want to have something happen about the use of pesticides, that first-person character either has to read an article about it, see it on TV, have a conversation with their friend, run into a exterminator. You know, you have to create this plot where pesticides come up and you play out whatever it is that you wanted to say about pesticides. It's kind of a dumb example, but it is an example from the book probably. I mean, it is. I know it is. This way, I could sort of have this more omniscience where you could break up scenes with sort of here, by the way, is what's going on outside the world. So you're very close to these people, whether it's the carousel operator doing what he's doing or this couple coming unglued. Then you could step back and say, here's what's going on in the outside world. And then you come back to this very personal stories of these people. And I liked the rhythm that created. And I liked the kind of sometimes a little bit of the confusion, a little bit of the dreaminess that it created. And I think if it works right for a reader, and not all books work for all readers, but it is more immersive because you're just deeper and deeper into this world, you know, both the people in it and what's going on around it. You know, I almost thought of them as like little news blurbs, you know, that kind of in between like commercial breaks or something, like an old TV show and you had a little commercial break that was not a commercial but was a news brief. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of in my weird brain what I was after.
But as I experienced it, it was hard for me to kind of keep track of them. But after I finished the book, I went back through and just read the interstitials all in a row.
Look at you. This is why you're so good at this. I mean, honestly, that's amazing.
And so that first one, you hit that meta point where you find out is this about the person who wrote the book, the last book?
Yeah.
And
right.
so it's we start asking questions about you and say, what the hell's going on, Eric?
I know. What is going on? I don't even know. I have no idea what's going on with me.
Are you trying to confess something to
us? No, I'm really not. You know, I think my books, on some level, there's certain parts of every character, and I will not tell you which, but certain parts of every character are a little bit derivative of me or people I've known. And I just – that is how I write. To do six characters, are they all derivative of me in some really exact way? No. But there's some things that go into all of them, back to Shimmer and back to, you know, Something Pretty and City. I'm not telling biography or autobiography in that sense. Not there'd be anything wrong with that, but I just – I'm not. But there is something derivative of me and my life experiences in all those characters.
I've heard some writers say you have to put a part of yourself in every single character.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of how that's certainly how I have to do it. But I also like the freedom, and the third person really helped, and these kind of somewhat imagined worlds really help with breaking it away from me. Just I'm not as interesting as the people the lives these six people have are way more interesting in my life, you know. You know, it's interesting about the little interstitial pieces, because I wrote it. I don't do a ton of outlining, but I had to have a certain amount of outlining with that just to kind of keep everything clear. And I have all that. I mean, the publisher didn't want to put it in the book. I can't remember if I floated it with him. It didn't really come up as I remember it, but probably on social media when the book is out, I'll put it up there. There's a very clear map of who everybody is in those interstitial sections, how they relate to other books, back to City, back to Shimmer, back to Something Pretty. So for people, you know, maybe you're confused by it or something. I mean, I don't mean to be confusing. I mean to just kind of create this sort of dreaminess. But if it's frustrating, I mean, we might as well put it there. It's like Absalom Absalom. At the end of Absalom Absalom, there's in later editions, they put a character descriptions of everybody because it was so confusing for people. I liked looking at that. Other people are like, no, you just read it with the confusion and then piece it all together. I don't know that either is right. 100 Years of Solitude is that way. I don't think that family tree that's in the opening of 100 Years of Solitude, I don't think that was in original editions. I could be wrong about that. But I liked having that family tree, and I love that book. And it didn't feel like a cheat or cliff notes. It was actually just kind of an interesting thing to go back and forth to the family tree in the front. But I think that was a later add in the editions of that book.
And also, we had another book recently, American Pop by Snowden Wright, that had a family tree at the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And his book was told in a nonlinear fashion. And so you knew when everyone was going to die.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he didn't keep any of that secret from the reader. I mean, he presaged people's deaths 40 years ahead in the story.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. You know, it's like when, you know, like Shimmer opens, I mean, in the first five pages, I'm not giving anything away to say that Shimmer's about a company built on a lie. I mean, it's the end of the prologue is, and, you know, the company's going to go under. So I think there's a certain amount of stuff that you want to keep, you know, suspense or drama or, you know, kind of what you're building towards in terms of plot. But I think there's a lot that is you want to be really clear about, and you don't need to hide that stuff, like a character's death. I mean, you can start a scene with saying that, you know, long before, you know, John Smith died, he did X, Y, and Z. And you're like, oh, that can play with people's expectations of, well, if I already know he's dying, why do I want to read about this person? But I do want to read about this person. And knowing that he's about to die makes it even more interesting, because how did he end up at that place, you know? So I think I like narratives that play around with time, that play around with your expectations that way, that bounce between people. So clearly I'm trying to, you know, more and more I'm doing that.
But are the chapters in this book, are they fairly – everything's happening simultaneously throughout there?
Yeah. I did have to do a timeline. I mean, I wrote it without – I had some kind of timeline in my head. But as the characters converge, I had to sort of go and back – I have a spreadsheet somewhere, very simple, but a spreadsheet somewhere that certain key moments in each of the six characters, I had to kind of sync those up within a few days so that I knew that the six separate narratives, when they came together, they would come together sensibly. And I probably had to go back and change a handful of things. But I always knew I was going to bring them together, so it wasn't that hard to sync it up. But sometimes I would have to get it down to the days. You know, it's kind of like the tsunami thing. I mean, 150 miles is obviously extreme and unprecedented. But if you go on the internet, which is a place where you can only find factual information, as you know, you can find these tsunami calculator. They're really awesome. And these scientists put them together, and they will sort of, if you had a catastrophic series of events, you can do it anywhere. You pinpoint your fault line and it will calculate out, you know, the flood that would ensue. And so I did spend some time doing that and saying, well, yeah. And then I had to do a spreadsheet on, because they're driving away from the tsunami, how fast would the wave move and how fast could they move and the distance. And mean, I don't do a ton of that stuff, but I actually, with certain things, I have to, in terms of syncing up the characters when you have so many. You know, you can push the limits of people's notion of what's possible, but you got to base it a little bit in fact. A car moves at a certain speed and a wave moves at a certain speed. So you've got to find a certain foundation of a fact for that, or logic, I guess is the better word, to make that work.
How big of a quake on the Richter scale would it take to get that wave?
I can't remember. It was pretty big, you know, 7 or 8, you know, it was pretty high, and I had to play around with it a little bit, and you had to have a high tide. And I mean, there were a few factors that
the hurricane had the storm surge.
But I mean, you know, that stuff goes back to, you know, what killed the levees in Katrina was less the size of the hurricane. It was probably the timing, you know, and that gets forgotten sometimes.
Well, the levees popped a couple of days later, too.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you some of it is playing with historical things that have happened. And more than anything, actually, I keep focusing on Katrina. What I was really thinking about was the Japanese tsunamis. I mean, that was really what was on my mind. The ones from, 20 years ago in Thailand that wiped out. We forget because mm-hmm. we sort of live in
Indonesia and everything.
Indonesia. I mean, that was tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who – it was – we just forget because we think, well, that happened elsewhere. But tens of thousands of people were killed in those Indonesian – and I think it was – I thought it was Thailand too.
It hit both places.
Yeah. So – and this is apparently how I spend my free time. If you look at the video just on YouTube of the flooding, the Japanese tsunami, the Fuki that ultimately brought down the reactor – it is more horrifying than any horror movie you've ever seen because it's kind of slow motion. You know, and there are scenes on these kind of Japanese plains, this kind of farmland, of waves coming and cars racing ahead of them and not making it. And it's not that the wave is moving at 60 miles an hour. It's that they hit a turn in the road or they hit a bump or something, and it slows that car down and they get subsumed by it. And so, again, this is an extreme book, but this stuff that happens, quote, elsewhere is more real than I think sometimes we want to admit.
Now, you said that your characters have more interesting lives than you, and I don't think that's correct because the restaurant manager in Section 2 lives a life of quiet desperation, and you can't hear it because the winds are howling so bad outside.
Yeah. The restaurant manager was funny to write. I think in part, and you know, to the degree I think about this stuff as clearly as I should, everyone else was having such extreme things happen. So I needed sort of a character in that mix to whom a minimal amount was happening, whose life was actually incredibly routine. You say quiet desperation. That seems kind of mean in my mind. In my mind, it was more just sort of maybe just more of boredom, you know, and of some loneliness. You might be right because I really – and I don't mean that in a coy way. If he came across as desperate, that's probably real. In my mind, it was much more a sort of life of that was lived in a very narrow band, like it's kind of some variation of what you were saying before, that his band is just – you know, he works at this restaurant. He's a good manager. He respects his employees. He wants to do well. He has an idea that he wants to own his own restaurants. He's not that interested in dating. He likes to eat ice cream. Like, I mean, he just has these kind of, you know, he's kind of estranged from his mother and his a little bit his brother. And that's what he does. He's not like, unlike the other people who have these really extreme things happening, he very much does not, at least, you know, until the end.
I liked how well you thought out the problems of wind would be, and that how he has to park his car in a certain direction so he can actually get the door open and get it closed.
These are the kinds of things I obsess over, particularly like, you know, I know I'm not alone with this. Not all writers like this, but a lot of them, you know, you're just constantly fighting procrastination when you're writing. I mean, you're just always, there's some other thing I could do before I actually start writing. And this was the most efficient, as I was saying earlier, the most efficient writing I've ever done, and for a variety of reasons, known and unknown. But that kind of thing of like thinking through the wind, I can get pretty obsessed about, you know, and just kind of thinking through, because then I don't have to write. I just have to think through, like, how would you do that? And the billboards that get worn down and kind of in my mind orienting his whole – the city where he lives, you know, to that wind. And yeah, so I appreciate that you respected, like, the degree to which – where the doors are and all that stuff. That's kind of the most interesting thing that happens in his life, actually.
He wanted to change the entrance of the restaurant to the other side.
Yeah. This guy doesn't have a lot going on, so he's just dealing with the wind.
Now, the last main character we know is the doctor.
Yeah.
And he is from, we presume, a Latin American country. He speaks Spanish as his native language. It's somewhere to the south of the country in question of the apocalypses. And for some reason, he wants to go there.
Yeah.
It's because there's so much crime in his city to the south. His wife is a successful professional as well. And who knew that Donald Trump's walls were so effective in keeping people out?
I know. I wrote this in, I think I wrote most of this before the election. I know I did because I was writing it in 2016. Trump was talking about walls and other people were talking about walls. Almost am worried that it got so literal because he then – President Trump then got so literal. I was really explicitly jumping on – but maybe that's okay. I don't know. That part was interesting to me because, again, you write these books long before they are published. But the notion of it is nonetheless the same. There are many people who for many years have talked about walls. At that time, I probably had – walls around Israel in my mind as much as I did border walls in Mexico, because Israel's farther along with that and the kind of ramifications of walls and border walls and immigration and how people react to that, and kind of, at least as the book plays out, the kind of the wildly imperfect, put it lightly, solution that a wall and camps create. The camps were, as much as anything, you know, when I was writing this, Syria was coming unglued. The camps in Jordan and in Turkey and in various parts of Syria as that country was coming unglued. That was as much on my mind, I think, as Mexico and President Trump's wall proposals as it was, you know what I mean? And also the idea that professionals, because around the time, probably before I was writing it and probably what was embedded in my brain, again, like I can't joke enough, and it's really serious, how much of this was derivative of stories I was reading in the New York Times about things going on in the world. And you would read about doctors and professionals having to flee Syria in the face of ISIS and of just the civil war and of everything. So it's one of the few sort of ethnic location kind of references is that he does speak Spanish. And I fought with myself forever about whether I should say, go ahead and say Spanish or some other language, but that just seemed to kind of like contrived and difficult on the reader.
Because we're always facing a crisis now, it seems. You know, it reminded me of the people who are contained under the overpasses in El Paso.
Yeah. You know, I have family up in the Northwest, and, you know, so something pretty takes place in Tacoma, Washington, and I still have family in Portland and Tacoma and friends in Seattle and so on. And the level of homelessness up there for years now has been beyond anything we in Memphis and in many parts of the country that people experience. There's a line in the book about homeless kids on a bridge lined up, kind of hanging out one after the other, after the other, after the other. Some are doing drugs, some are in prostitution of some sort, some are just sleeping, and it's blocks and blocks of it. That's real. That's been the case in Portland. And there's a line in the book about how those homeless kids, because they are basically kids, are kind of kept in a certain place in a sort of unspoken bargain with the police. And that's what Portland did for years. I think it's the Hawthorne Bridge towards downtown. And I remember we were coming back late at night walking and having a great time and turn this corner. And then there's these blocks of these kids hanging out homeless. And I think the other thing about that is that particularly in the South and in the Northeast, for many, many people, their mind's eye pictures those homeless kids as African-American or Hispanic or in some case non-white. And in that case, because it's the Northwest, it's predominantly, I mean, overwhelmingly white kids. That doesn't make it any better or worse. It's just, I think that's that thing where we say, oh, that's what happens over there, or that's what happens with those kinds of people. But actually, Portland, one of the great cities in America, a wealthy city, has a homeless issue.
Liberal city.
A liberal city has a homeless issue that is just breathtaking. And Seattle does too, in terms of camps, and more so even, I mean, more and more. It's unbelievable.
When I lived in Hamburg, Germany,
yeah,
there's massive squats there. It's the Rotiflora,
yeah,
squats.
Yeah.
Just thousands of people living in abandoned buildings, and then buildings that they essentially took over and refused to let be developed.
Right. I remember when my kids were little, they were probably 8, 9, 10, and we took them to Paris. And it's when the rioting was going on. So this was probably 8, 9 years ago. And the rioting among the mostly migrant populations that had been really relegated to the outsides of the city, they were rioting, they were burning tires and protesting their treatment. And those kinds of things get in my brain, you know, and stick with me. So here's Paris, one of the world's great cities, in a liberal democracy, a social democracy that values, you know, its safety nets and its program. This is pre-austerity. This is pre the rise of the right wing right now, or right-leaning parties and so on. They were not dealing well with their immigrant populations who were screaming, this is not good enough. And that was Paris 10 years ago, you know? So I think all these kinds of things that go on in city, particularly in cities, I mean, I'm kind of focused on that, all come back and I sort of play them out. And back to why not name the cities, I like to pull a little bit of Portland, a little bit of Paris, a little bit of Detroit, a little bit of New York, you know, a little bit of Memphis, a little bit of New Orleans, start pulling these things together. I could call it Fantasy City or have some name for it, but I might as well just let it, again, be unnamed and kind of anonymous.
Are the yellow vests going to find your way, their way into a new
exactly.
book of yours?
Maybe. I mean, Above the Ether may have said when we did the city interview, you know, in part it came from, there's a line in the book where as people start coming to the city, the narrator, the writer is talking to somebody who says, you know, I do a bad job quoting myself, but what you all have in emptiness, we have in overflowing rats and roaches and cats and dogs and everything that left here, because city's a city that in the city where we once lived, that city, nothing will grow there. But this guy tells him like, no, outside the city and other places, it's not that things won't grow, it's that it won't stop growing. And those ideas that I kind of thought, well, I might come back to that. And that was really the beginning of the whole book of Above the Ether, was this idea of what's going on outside the city and the contrasts and so on. There's a line in Above the Ether about people, survivalists, barricading themselves in kind of public lands. And that what I'm working on now is kind of derived of that. So the yellow vest, maybe, I don't know.
It's kind of like Clive and Bundy, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, very much so.
Before we spoke last time, you were starting up on a new venture.
Yeah.
And it has since launched, the Daily Memphian.
Yes.
Memphis's new community newspaper here. So what has that experience been like for you?
It's been great. We're over 6 months now. You know, we're a paywall-driven subscriber, online-only news site, and we have exceeded our numbers on subscriptions and sponsorships, and we structured it as a nonprofit, as a lot of local news sources are being structured these days. But we wanted it to be on a path to sustainability so that it would pay for itself versus constantly raising money. And we're not there yet. We weren't supposed to be. It's kind of a 4 or 5 year plan to get to sustainability. The reaction has been great. I mean, I think exceeded what we thought. The expectations have also been higher than we expected, you know, and that's a good thing. But we've had to staff up. I think we added 5 people in the newsroom since launch, and we really need to add another 10 to 15. We'll see if that happens. But it takes a lot of people to cover a city well. Good so far.
I just saw the Cleveland Plain Dealer just really slashed its staff.
That was amazing. I mean, they're down to 33 people. The Cleveland Plain Dealer was a really – I mean, people who aren't maybe into news as much as I am and you are, that was a great paper, a great local paper that was covered at city, you know, comprehensively, did investigative journalism, fun stuff. I mean, and the number was unbelievable. They were 340 in the newsroom about 20 years ago. So they've had a 90% reduction in their newsroom. The Commercial Appeal, and I don't mean to pick on them, I mean, but the Memphis Commercial Appeal was over 200 people just 15 years ago, 210, 220, and they're down to something like 40 now. So not as bad as Cleveland Plain Dealer, but it's pretty remarkable what's happening nationwide. And then you look at even smaller communities where the papers are just gone, you know, I mean, they've just shut down in small communities. And that's even a bigger problem, I think, because cities at least, I mean, people, maybe they'll pull off the nonprofit thing like we're doing, or they'll find some other, maybe in Miami, the NPR station there has expanded its local news. I mean, they have a newsroom of 25 people in the local Miami NPR affiliate. So there's cities have enough money and interest to make some, you know, to fill some gaps. I don't think any city's ever going to, like of the size of Memphis or Cleveland's ever going to see a 200-person newsroom again. But you start looking at communities, you know, of 10 and 20,000 people, there things just aren't going covered in those places.
You were really busy, and I think it was hard for you to find time to write before. How is it now with another paper?
Well, I haven't written much. You know, this book I finished, Above the Ether, I finished the bulk of that work in 2016. Then there was editing and, you know, that kind of stuff that went on, the process of selling it and so on. So I think we signed the contract a year ago, and, you know, then there's some more editing. But that doesn't take as much time as writing. I very explicitly want – I kind of need a little break from writing. So I probably took a 6-month break from writing, which is one of the bigger breaks I've taken in the last, you know, couple decades, which was fine. I was just going to frustrate myself if I tried to write while launching the Daily Memphian and working 12-plus hours a day. Daily Memphian has calmed down enough. We've got a rhythm now, and so I have started writing some again. You know, I don't need a ton of time to write. I just need regularity. So I need to be able to write 5 out of 7 days a week for maybe an hour at a time. I tend to write in the morning, a little bit on the weekends. And if I get the rhythm going of just consistency of writing, I'll get productive. Day one, I won't get much done. Day two, but then I'll look at the end of the week. I'll go, wow, actually, you know, I wrote this week. I got stuff done. So I'm back to where I have consistency writing.
Do you think journalism has helped you be able to get words down on the page, even if you're not feeling it?
Yeah. Particularly when I was a working reporter. I mean, I was only a working reporter for a short period of time, but I worked at a small town paper in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, right out of college. And, you know, I was doing 5 to 7 stories a week. And that really, any hesitation or, you know, I need the room to be perfect and, you know, I can only write with certain music, all that stuff got killed. And even a small town newspaper, because the grind was so hard and so you just had to write and write and write. It was great training in that way. I mean, that year I worked there, how many hundreds of articles I wrote. I mean, it was crazy. And it was really good training in that sense. So, and then the other journalistic writing I've done and marketing writing I've done has been helpful, kind of segmenting my mind of there's this kind of writing, this kind of writing, this kind of writing. And then there's the fiction writing that is what I really want to do. But it helps you kind of understand all the different parts.
So do you have a ballpark on when the next book might see the light of day?
I don't. I mean, I think I've got 120 horrible, terrible, good-for-nothing pages, some of which I love. And I, you know, lately I've been sort of on this kind of, the last few books have been, you know, kind of 220, 30 pages. And so ostensibly I'm halfway through it and starting to find my way. I haven't, like I said, I hadn't been focused on it. So it's only in the last month that I've gotten really focused on it again. And, you know, ask me in 3 months, we'll see where I am.
Okay, Eric, thanks so much for stopping by today. And you're going to be at Novel signing the book. When is that coming?
That is on June 11th, night of June 11th.
Everyone, stop by and say hi and get your book signed. Once again, thank you so much for stopping by. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Eric Barnes is the author of Above the Ether, which is published by Arcade and distributed by Simon & Schuster. Eric will be at the bookstore Novel, located at 387 Perkins Extended in Memphis, on Tuesday, June 11th at 6 p.m. to sign Above the Ether. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.